Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, product owners all over this great big world, including people listening in Egypt, specifically in Cairo. Welcome back to Deliver Your Agile Product Owners Podcast. My name is Corey Bryan, and I am ready for the next iteration. I've been doing some planning, some ideas. I got a class that's starting this week. Lots of things that I'm wanting to do, so I'm actually going to go and do them. So good time to do a new iteration for me. We're going to have a guest today, but first, a couple articles that I read that I thought were very interesting. The first one was over at scrum.org from Simon, who has the first of two articles called "The Best Two Product Owners I Ever Worked With." And in this first one, he describes Matthew, somebody who was very demanding, was not a traditional product owner in the sense, but that grew into the role. And the things that he really liked, the things that resonated with me about Matthew was that he did put the customer first. He was approaching things from a customer perspective. He understood what they were trying to do, the problems they faced, and was always willing to put the customer first. I really appreciate that. Another thing was making decisions with a diverse group. Again, I tend to gravitate toward decision-making and decision processes. I really like the fact that Matthew was making those decisions with a wide variety of different group members and was able to help everybody come together. And something else that he had was he was demanding. He still remained demanding. He had high standards. He had high expectations. He was empowered to do the role, something that I think is very important and very powerful. So really good article. I can't wait to see the second one from Simon. But I thought, since I like talking about what good things product owners do, then of course this really resonated with me. So go check it out. Next article is from Ken Sandy, who has an article called "Something is Not Right in Modern Product Management." It's a good short article that details some of the things that he's seeing as a consultant when he goes into organizations, specifically with product management. He has a great quote in here of, he sees product managers tirelessly grind out incremental value. Most of us tirelessly grind out incremental value with the utmost commitment for an end customer that will rarely appreciate all that's going on behind the curtain. Lots of ducks furiously swimming underwater to get a little bit of value. I find that's true. Also, is it's not the big things you do, it's the little things you do added up that add up over time that really make the biggest impact, the biggest value that you're looking at. He does have a large section or a good section in here talking about the fear of senior leaders. The one that really stood out to me was a fear to allow product managers to independently draw their own conclusions through talking to customers versus an overweight to short-term prescribed stakeholder customers or sales demand. That's utter madness. I agree. Again, it's part of being product-led. There was an interesting tweet this week. It said being product-led is not the same thing as being product manager-led. And that's true. The product is what drives the value. The product for your customers are what drive the value. And the people, including the product managers, are the ones that help you understand that value, understand the needs, and drive that forward. And another quote he has in this article is that we ensure the understanding within all organizations of what we do and the value we can bring. If only we're empowered to do it. We, the product people, are empowered to do the job. Again, something I've harkened back with Melissa Perry's book and Marty Kagan is the empowered notion and being able to do the job. Just let us do the job the way that it's supposed to be done, the best way that it's done, and that will make all the difference. A really good article from Ken, a really interesting site over at productprofessionals.com. So we'll have a link to those in the show notes. And now let's get to our guest.
No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
My guest today is a former Navy submarine captain who has written two best-selling books. He has frequent leadership nudges, and that I enjoy very much, by the way, keynotes at conferences, including Agile conferences, and is someone who's had a really big impact on how I've changed leadership styles in the last few years. It's my pleasure to welcome David Marquet to the show. Hello, Captain Marquet.
Thanks, Corey. Thanks for having me on your Deliver It podcast.
So I have been a fan of David's, as I'm sure most people have, reading books and learning more. In fact, one of the episodes, and we'll talk about that, it was inspired by your last book. And really, I wanted to talk about speaking with intent. It's something I've been doing more of lately, something I've been trying to get other people to do more lately too, is speak with intent. And I thought, why not just talk to David? Why not just talk to the source of where I got the idea from, about why intent is so important, especially for product leaders and in agile contexts. So thank you very much for joining, David.
Yeah. So my experience was growing up in what I call a permission-based environment, which I think is probably about 99% of the organizations on the planet. And permission-based organizations, the default language, the default communication structures are getting permission, asking for permission, and then trying to get permission. And so this comes with a whole host of characteristics. For example, while I'm waiting for permission, I'm not doing anything. I'm waiting.
Right.
I can't get the meeting. I can't get my boss's attention, whatever it happens to be. It also tends to remove responsibility from the scene of action because, quote, executives higher up in the organization, further removed from the action, are making decisions based on information that's been channeled and filtered to them by the organization. And it tends, bottom line, is a whole host of issues. It's what the industrial organization, it's what the default industrial organization, industrial age organization came up with, because it's fundamentally designed to stop people from doing stuff because it's all about control.
Yeah.
And it's not what's going to win, obviously, in the next 100 years. And the alternative, most people, or the cognitive trick is that the alternative is people go to a just do it type of structure, or they try to go to a just do it structure. But this also has problems. Just do it, people communicate less because they don't have to communicate, because I already have the authority. I don't need to talk to my boss. People actually assume less risk embracing profiles because there's less of a safety net, and we don't think that's the right kind of way to run an organization, because you're running a nuclear reactor or a nuclear submarine. You don't want people just doing stuff.
Yeah.
So I'd heard this there'd been snippets of this as I came up through the Navy, but we implemented it wholesale, which was, the idea was the default communication was not permission. The default communication was not just do it. The default communication became intent. And when I say the default, what I meant was this was the aspirational communication that it wasn't always intent. Sometimes people had to wait for permission, and sometimes they just took action. But the design mean spot, the design weighting of the organization was that we were going to strive to use intent. And it was unbelievably powerful and useful for me as the leader, and powerful for the team. And that's how we came to practice this intent-based leadership.
Yep. And that's a lot of that is in your first book, which I love, Turn the Ship Around, True Story, Turning Followers into Leaders. And you say that phrase, that I intend to phrase, turn those passive followers that you had into active leaders. And using words like intent, also purpose, originate, launch, those types of words can help there. And I really thought that was a really good way to talk about product people, because we mean to do a lot of things. And stating that up front, or stating that with teams and getting teams to state that with us, is very powerful.
Yeah. So if you're the product owner, if you're responsible for delivering a product, you want to deliver the product that will solve the person's problem, which triggered them to ask for the product. A lot of times we don't know. I mean, if I knew what it was I wanted, I would ask for it. Or sometimes we ask for things and it's not really what I want.
Exactly.
And it's not until we actually build version zero and we test it, we realize different things. So what you want, I think, two things. You want the team. You want to manage your team in a way that there's bursts of activity and then pauses for reflection. And then this is really the rhythm that wins. And the question that you need to solve, that you need to answer, is how long is the period of activity, and then how long do I dedicate to the burst of to the reflection, and then how does that change over the course of the delivery of the product? And in general, we think that you want shorter periods of action and more frequent reflection periods early, when there's more freedom of maneuver and there's more uncertainty in what the product's going to look like, and then toward the end when you're it's pretty much all fleshed out. Okay, it's got four wheels, it's got a steering wheel, it's got a windshield. It's basically, you know, it's a car, but it's going to have an electric motor instead of a combustion. Okay, great. Now we're in production mode. Now we're just, let's get the thing done. Yeah. So your job isn't so much to say, oh, you know what, let's make a car with three wheels or let's make a car with four wheels. Your job is to manage the rhythm of the team so that the team, through their behaviors and activities, comes up. The answer becomes evident as a result of the rhythm of our work.
Yeah. Something that you've got in one of the videos in your leadership, intent-based leadership site, is talking about that, the fact that giving that intent or having others give the intent lets them own that problem, own that solution, whatever it is psychologically. I really like that. I mean, it's important that when people talk about product ownership, we're not just talking about one person with one role. We're talking about, at least for me, I want to have everybody have that sense of ownership of this is what we're doing, this is the problem we're solving, and this is how we can go about that. So, and I think intent really does lead to that.
Yeah. So the key, there are limits to intent.
Okay.
I'll give you a couple of them. First of all, you can't intend for someone else to do something. So I can't say, Corey, I intend for you to wear a blue shirt at this podcast.
Right.
Intent is about what you're going to do, number one. Number two is you should be able to, let me put it this way, on the submarine, intent was pushed down to the point where the person had full authority over what was needed to make that happen. So the engineer, so for example, starting the reactor is something that the engineer is responsible for. Now, within the engineering department, there are five separate divisions, but none of the divisions by themselves could start the reactor. There were sort of like electrical, mechanical, reactor control, reactor laboratory. And it wouldn't have made sense to push the intent for starting the reactor down to their level. But once the engineer says to me, hey, I intend to start the reactor, there are supporting behaviors that those teams can take. And then they report, okay, here's what we intend to do. Okay, I intend to bring my guys in 2 hours ahead of time so that we're ready to go and whatever. Intent, it shifts the ownership. And I can't tell you how many times it was so hard for me. I would come in the control room and I'd be, we're doing the wrong thing. We're heading in the wrong direction. The enemy's this way, or, you know, whatever it happened to be. And I just so wanted to blurt out, turn around, go turn the ship around. And I would say, oh, I'd have to back up. And because that's a shortcut. It's a trick. It's like a double shortcut, because it feels like, oh, well, now we're moving in the right direction. But you've just reinforced codependency. Right. And you just also reinforce fragility, because if you're wrong, it's less likely the team will speak up. So I would have to say, hey, all right, hey, guys, pull out. Like, what are we trying to do here? Oh, we're trying to protect the aircraft carrier. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Where's the aircraft carrier? Where's the enemy? Where do you think we should be? Over there. Oh, why are we going this? Oh, I see. Let's turn around. I intend to turn around and head in this direction. Great. Do that. Now I got people thinking. So, I mean, that's kind of a silly example, but the idea is you want to build a team that can think and make decisions without you. Mm-hmm. And too many leaders are addicted to the psychological juice that comes when, oh, look at all these people standing outside my door and I'm such an important person, and they all have to line up one after another, and then I adjudicate like Solomon on, you know, what your issue is and who gets rewarded and who not.
Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that the word that kept coming up in my notes as I was looking through this that I highlighted from both of the books and a few other things was that you continue to see the benefits of deliberate action. And that word deliberate, I think, speaks to why you're doing that intent. Is I'm being very specific about what I want to do. I've done that with my family when I say, look, these are the four things I'm going to do today. I intend to do this, this, and this. I've done it when I'm cleaning some things. I've said it out loud. I'm going to clean this part, do this, and set this down. But I'm being very specific, very deliberate about doing that, so that somebody could stop me, so that people know that, you know, I'm going to ride my bike at 2 p.m. or I'm going to have coffee at this time, or just whatever it is. I'm just putting it out there for somebody to tell me that I'm wrong, or at least so that they know.
Or at least so they know what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
This was such an important thing for us. And it played out at very different scales. At the most micro scale, it played out at I'm reaching forward to push a button. Like I'm reaching forward to push the enter key on the keyboard that will update us, the launch this software update on the server, to making a deliberate action about which way to turn the submarine. Mm-hmm. And the problem, we have an epidemic of people we have an epidemic of sheep. You have an epidemic of people going through their lives.
Yeah.
And it's not like someone else is necessarily controlling them. It's just no one is controlling. They're just an auto. And every the things that they say, I can't tell you how many times we do workshops with executives and I ask them things like, well, why did you ask the question that way? And why did you run the meeting that way? And why did you, you guys had this important decision to make and the way you approached it was, you stated the organization's desire and then you had people discuss it and then you voted. Why did you do it like that? No idea. They just do it because they've always seen it that way.
Yeah.
Not because of some deliberate thought process that it's the best way to do it. And man, we would have such a better world. And oh, by the way, all those quote Instagram influencers would be out of a job if people just thought for themselves.
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. So I'm really kind of frustrated. At the end of the day, it's harder for me as I'm getting older. When I was young, I remember I could go to the library at 7 in the morning as soon as it opens up. And I could stay there for 14 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't do that kind of cognitive lifting anymore. But you, when you're really cognitively involved, it should feel very fatiguing and taxing. Yeah. Yeah. But people shy away from that. And that's too hard. And so we don't do it. And we have our brains are designed to do that. It's not like we're bad people or something. You know, I'm a better person than you or anything. It's just your brain is designed to minimize the cognitive burden.
Yeah.
And that makes us take shortcuts. And one of the key shortcuts is do what everyone else is doing.
Yeah. You had a quote in your book when you had that inspection, the first book, when you had an inspection and they said, your guys tried to make the same mistakes, but either they stopped themselves or they were stopped by a teammate.
Right.
I think that's a really good indication of when you're being deliberate with something, when you're being vocal about something, when you're thinking out loud, you get people to invest in what you're doing and to help you. And you can help others as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many times we get lectured on act like be a team, you're a team, it's all a team. We get that too. Yeah, great. That's not something I didn't know. The problem is, what is the mechanism that you're going to do? What's the behavior that you will practice that allows you to act like a team?
Right.
And at this point, the quote leader who's giving you a lecture to be a team falls mute because they don't have the foggiest clue. Yeah. And it was like saying, oh, take care of your people. Make it feel safe for your people. Or create a team cooperative environment. Great. How do you want me to do that? Well, that's your job. Yeah. So those statements are more about holding you, quote, accountable later if it doesn't play out that way than actually doing anything beneficial with the culture. In any event, so anyway, backing up from that rant. It allowed us, when people would say, they would announce what they're doing and pause, it would allow the rest of the team to help out. So when my daughter was learning to drive a couple decades ago, I was nervous. I was in the car. I would see something and I wouldn't hear. Like when people are driving, you don't normally hear them saying things. They're just driving along silently. And and that's fine for people who know how to drive. But I kept interjecting. I said, oh, do you see the family? Do you see the car? Do you see the stop sign? Do you see the... And she got frustrated with me. She said, of course I do. And I said, well, I don't know that you see it because I'm not hearing anything from you.
Right.
So... She was there. And I said, why don't you do this? I'll be quiet if you tell me what you're seeing. So we're driving along. She's saying, okay, I see the family. I see the car. I see the stop sign. And it's a way of being in control of yourself. It's a way of maintaining maximum freedom. Now, it's not normal because our general experience is with people who know how to drive. So then we cast off that. We don't need to do that anymore. But at work, it's really a beneficial behavior because we're always doing new projects and that just, hey, we call it expose your thinking. Here's what I see, here's what I think.
Very cool. And there's ways that I can think of where product people see this a lot. It's in our daily stand-ups. The team members are telling us or telling each other really, I'm going to work on this story. That's their intent. I'm going to intend to work on these things. When we're doing a sprint review or reviewing a roadmap or something else, that we intend to go after these types of customers or we intend to deliver this type of capability in the next week or something like that. We can state our intent like that often. And frequently I do that because I want to know if I'm wrong. I want to know, am I on the right path? Do others see this differently? And if they do, they can tell me because I'm going to give them something to argue against. That's one of the reasons that I've found to be able to do that very valuable.
Right. Yeah, and I've seen those stand-ups, and some of them are pretty good. But what happens is the most powerful intent statements are about decisions that we're making. And it tends to be a list of actions that I'm taking, we would use the word I plan to. So okay. I would say, like, I plan to fly to Chicago. I intend to sign a contract with XYZ company.
Okay.
So flying to Chicago, tying my shoes, whatever, going through TSA, those are all just actions. There's no real decision there.
Okay.
And then the intent is, the purpose of it is to crystallize and highlight and make more visible what really matters here. Signing the contract. I'm going to fly to Chicago, sign a contract, come back. Of that whole 6-hour chunk of time, the only thing that really matters is the 30 seconds when I'm signing that contract.
Yeah.
So people get confused. Everything's important. And so the idea is to what's really important. And trying to think of some other examples, but you can probably think of them where when you're designing the product, a bunch of things don't matter.
Right. A lot of them.
So when you're making a car, it's going to probably have 4 wheels. I mean, there's some guys experimenting.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I see, we intend to go after this customer first, or this is the most important customer for us.
That's a decision. Yeah. That's a decision. That's a prioritization decision.
Right. And then there's all kinds of actions that the team or the business or whatever will do to pursue that intent. So that's exactly. Similar to your example of the enemies in this water. We want to go, our mission is this. So we're going to go do that.
Yeah, I'm going to reposition the submarine to this area. Okay, great. There's a lot of things that are now going to happen. Rudder is going to turn. We're going to change some charts. We're going to all these other, but those are simply action in support of the decision.
Right.
The interesting thing happens when organizations make mistakes is what's typically visible is the last action that was taken.
Right.
So the mistake is blamed on the action.
The last action.
We end up looking at a bunch of, accident kind of situations or critiques or errors and that kind of stuff. And so what happens is it's very easy to blame the last action when it turns out that the mistake, there was a decision made 20 years ago that basically if you drew a line from that decision, there was a high probability that we would be in the situation that we're in today.
Yep. And as I was thinking through the word intend and looking at the places I use it and trying to think through some examples of it, one of the phrases that I've used quite often, alarmingly often, is that was not my intent. When something happened and I did some action or I took some, I was trying to do something and somebody said, you know, that they misinterpreted and I said that was not my intent. I think I know what I mean by that, but when you hear that phrase that was not my intent, is that something that's along these same lines? Is that totally different? Is that me making excuses? I'm not sure.
Let me make sure I understand. You've told the team, hey, here's what we're trying to accomplish. They come back to you and say, hey, here's what I intend to do in order to accomplish that. And you say, no, that wasn't what our intent was.
If I gave a customer that we're trying to pursue and the team went away and did something and they came back, this is assuming that I haven't seen it, which is rare, but they came back and said, here's what we're doing. And I said, well, that's not what I meant by when I said our intent is, or, you know, like you said, I can't give other people intent, but my intent was to go after this customer. We're going after a subset of that customer as an example.
Yeah, I didn't find myself saying that a lot. I'm not sure why. Maybe I just was clueless when those things happen. I would say, it sounds like in this case, like we're not fulfilling, we would call this an issue of clarity.
Okay.
So the issue, it's either clarity or competence. So the issue is either, so let's say we want to be really bold and go after some new customer set. We want to go after the flying into space company set or something. And the team is pretty shy about it and they're not very, they don't think broadly enough. So maybe they go after Branson's company and Elon Musk's company, but they're not going after, say, NASA or the Russian space company or Eurostat. Yeah, I would say, hey, look, I don't think we're thinking broadly enough about this. When I mean space companies, I mean all space companies, not just commercial companies. I said the word company, sure. So you could say, well, that's a commercial entity, but I really mean like anyone who launches anything into space. So it could be a government agency, military, company, whatever. So that's what I meant. But those things typically, I mean, it'll come to light. That friction point will come to light as you take that first few steps forward. You can sit there in the boardroom and talk about it all day long. Nothing happens. But you say, okay, and teams, in my opinion, tend to want more, quote, definition than is helpful.
Yeah.
Like, well, tell us this and this, but I don't understand. Like, stop asking questions. Just go work on it for 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, you've done zero brain power on this. Stop asking questions. I don't know. You don't know.
Yeah.
Like, go work on it for one day.
Yeah.
2 days or whatever it is. Just a really brief period of time. Okay. Now let's come back and have some real questions. So don't over-define what were the thing at the beginning, which Agile is really good about that.
So one of the things to circle back on that idea that you talked about, whereas thinking and doing work, in your last book, you talk about red and blue work, the thinking work and the doing work, and how the deciders in the Tayloristic model, the deciders decide what to do and the workers go and do it. And that's not at all what we want. We want what you're talking about, which is a little bit of some thinking and some doing. To the doing educates the thinking is put in practice by the doing.
Precisely. Yeah, it hit me. I started using this phrase leader, because it hit me that we have this leader-follower structure and no one ever questioned it. Like as I was growing up, we have leaders, we have followers. Well, of course we do. Like, well, why? And I'm sort of mincing words, but I think we're all leaders and we're all followers in the sense that we're all lead ourselves to follow the purposes of the organization, but this means everyone, including the person at the top, is also a follower of values.
Right.
So, but the problem is we've inherited a structure from the industrial age. You got to remember, the vast majority of humans didn't know how to read as recently as 200 years ago.
Yeah.
So people are starting to put together these complex organizations. They're starting to build factories, railroads, complex organizations with a workforce that really, a lot of them don't know how to read. So the structure is, okay, we, the white collar leaders of the organization, will make the decisions and you, the blue collar hands, all hands. We have all hands meetings because they were hired for their hands. Will do what we decided is that you should do.
Yeah.
And that structure is not the most helpful structure now. But the problem is the rituals and the language structures that stem from that are still existing. So we can go to an evolved tech company. And I went to a tech company last year for a talk, and they were having an all-hands meeting because that's a silly example, but these languages still, they persist. And the way we run meetings, more dangerously, the way we run meetings and the way we ask questions, will it work? Is it safe? Are you sure? These binary questions are all micro-coercions that are vestiges of the industrial age.
Yeah. And that's one thing I really took away. In fact, it's what I did a whole episode 117 about, was your seven types of bad questions. I took one of those. It really impacted me, which was probabilistic questions instead of binary questions. Things like, how safe are we to launch? What types of things might go wrong? To pull that out, ask probability. That's 117, speaking percentages, if anybody wants to listen to that. That's where the idea came from. I love those questions.
Yeah. Like, is the COVID vaccine safe? That is just a meaning. To me, it's a meaningless question because it's neither safe nor not safe. There's a degree of safety in taking is flying in an airplane safe? Well, how safe is it? How safe is the COVID? Now I can say, well, 100,000 people has a certain kind of reaction.
Yeah, and compared to what?
Now I can answer the question. Right, exactly. And relative to what? So getting out of bed is not safe because now you can slip.
Right.
So in any event, we had to relearn the language that we spoke at work because we were deeply infected by the industrial age binary language of certainty and arrogance.
Yeah.
And there were a few bright spots. For example, if we were to report submarine contact, we would often part of the form would say certain or possible or probable, like we'd have different scales like mm-hmm. that. But for the most part, things tended to be binary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's where with something I've gotten a lot better at is not starting questions with why, to start them with how, start them with what.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the things I've done as part of the books that you have and a part of the Agile Conversations books I've talked about before is I rewrite conversations in my head and on paper before I have them so that I can, when I know what I want to ask, which is why did you do that? But that's not the question I should ask. What I should ask is, what led you to that decision?
Yeah.
Or something like that. So I edit like 16 times to get to a better question. And so I don't start it with why.
Yeah, that's really hard, isn't it? Yeah, and sometimes it's probably okay to ask why, especially if you're in it's a pretty trusted, high trust relationship. But my experience is a person would come to me, so I'm as a submarine commander, and they would say, well, I'm thinking about doing this. And if I said, well, why? Why would you want to do that?
Yeah.
They tended to just say, oh, never mind. Yeah, I guess it's a bad idea. And I was like, I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I just need to know why. So why often sends a signal that you need to justify. In other words, I'm seeing something wrong or problematic in what you're telling me, and I need to hear the justification behind it. Now, you might want to hear how they came to that conclusion.
Absolutely.
What they saw that resulted in it. But I've tried to avoid why and ask a more neutral, like what you said. That's a great thing. Hey, what did you see? Or, tell me how you came to this conclusion.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be nervous about, first of all, celebrate. Hey, they're coming to me with initiative. They're coming to me with a new idea. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And then you're going to shut it down by asking a why question.
And the thing that I like doing with teams as well, when I'm working with teams and I get to that point and I really want to know because they know something I don't. And it will help me And it will help them if they can teach me what they know. That way, either I won't make a mistake in the future, or I'll have some more information when I when it comes time to make a decision in the future about that thing. I'll know to go back to them, or I'll know the information that they do. It's that information sharing, that two-way street, that I find so powerful with that.
Yeah, the people closer to the work are going to have, they're going to know more about the work. They're going to have much more contextual information about the work. So, exactly.
And that's one of the things you have in there as well, is that leaders need to create the environment for thinking, which is a pretty obvious statement, but not an environment for doing, not an environment for efficient work, which is something I keep getting beat about in the, you know, seeing, well, we need to be more efficient. No, I don't think so. I think we need to do better work. And that comes from the workers telling us what needs to be done. And that's part of the leader's job, is to set up the organization for that. Because as you say in the book, and it's obviously true, the organization is perfectly tuned to deliver the behavior we see. If you don't like the behavior, you have to change the organization.
Yeah, I'm reminded that we were working with this global construction company, and when I was working on one of their job sites and looking at how things were going. And basically the situation is this. Let's say you're putting up wooden framing, and you've got the frames and you got the guy driving nails, or some team, they're just like, they're putting them up and driving nails. And like the obvious thing is to beat on those guys to drive nails faster.
Yeah.
But then they would get done and then there'd be this big delay. Where's the windows? They're not here. Where's electrical? Plans not approved, or we got the plans, but no cabling. And then there'd be 2.5 days of dead time, or, this part's got to come down and we got to redo it because some decision was. And so the visual, we were attracted to that shiny thing, the guy with the nail gun. That's the visual activity. And so we want to say, okay, go faster with the nail gun. But that's not, like, you can go 1% faster with the nail gun. But making better decisions and closing those seams is going to make you 100% faster.
Yep. And you talk a lot about that as well, which is you have two approaches to do this, right? You can change your own thinking and hope this leads to new behavior, or you can change your behavior and hope this leads to new thinking. So act your way to new thinking.
Yeah, I love the change guys that come in, hey, 80% of all change initiatives fail, but you know, this one's going to be different somehow. And the reason they fail is because they're backwards. What we try to do is convince people that we say, oh, we need to be more agile. And then somehow we're going to be more agile. That's not how you are more agile. What you are, the way you get more agile, the way you develop an agile mindset, in my opinion, and we've seen it, and there's evidence to show this, is by practicing being agile in very small ways that start to build up. And then your brain wiring changes to embrace, and then you become agile. You think agile. You have an agile mindset.
Right.
The agile mindset follows agile, the implementation of agile practices. So if you want to prevent your agile transformation from ever happening, try and make sure everyone is, quote, convinced before you actually do anything. It'll never going to happen. So what you have to do is just take one tiny step.
Yes.
I liken it to, like, if you want to be, you want to like running, but you don't like running right now. Mm-hmm. Don't sit on the floor cross-legged contemplating running.
Yeah.
Buy a pair of running shoes, and for a week, put them next to your bed. And then for the next week, put them next to your bed. When you wake up, put them on. For the next week, put them on, walk around the block. For the next week, put them on, walk around the block twice and jog around. You know, that's what you do. And then a year from now, you'll be running a marathon and you'll like running.
One other thing I do, I play a little game with guests called Three Questions. The first question is, what are three apps or products that you use in your personal life, and tell me why you love them?
I use Otter.ai to record a lot of meetings because it creates transcripts.
Ah,
I don't have time to listen to the whole recording, but I could get a transcript. It's great. Otter.ai.
Very cool.
I'm trying to go to a different domain in my life. I have a I'm a triathlete and a swimmer, and I got this little chip timer which sits in my hat, mm-hmm. and it goes chirp, 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 and you can set it to the stroke count that you want. So if you want to swim 60 strokes a minute, yeah. you set it to 60 or 64 or 60. Anyway, my stroke count, the same was true with my running. Both have been too low. I'm sort of plodding along, and mm-hmm. what you want to do is increase the frequency. So I just put my chip counter to 60 when I'm swimming and 90 when I'm running, and choop, 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 choop.
Nice.
Choop.
Very cool. I didn't know that existed.
Yeah, it's a silly little thing, but
very cool.
It helps out. Okay. I also like, for running, my favorite thing now, I have these aftershocks.
Oh, headphones. Yes.
Over the ear. I couldn't get anything to stay in my ears.
Mm-hmm.
And the aftershocks sit over your ear, and you can hear the ambient noise. Because
yeah.
they're like bone conducting. They're really good. I like my Yeti microphone.
Yes. very good. Okay.
Yeah, it's a good question, because it's like, well, what's really helpful in your life? And I'm kind of ranging around in the different domains of my life to I was thinking about some kitchen stuff.
That's fine. I've been playing with coffee for the last month and a half, so I'm trying to find a new way to brew coffee. It's
Have
perfectly
you?
Fine, yeah.
I run an experiment every 10 years where I get a little French press or a Turkish yep. thing or an espresso, and I just always end up, I just have to go, still going back to Mr. Coffee, 12 cups, fill it up.
It's what you know. It's what you like. Perfectly fine.
Yeah, it's just, everything else is just too much work.
Okay. So there's a third question that I ask, which is, what product ideas are you most excited about for the future? What are some of the things you see on TV or hear about in the news, or people are talking about product ideas that you'd like to do?
I haven't seen this. The closest thing I've seen to this is, what was it called? Clout, I guess.
Hmm.
My problem is, I've got people on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram. They contact us at Zoho because they come through our website.
Yep.
People buy stuff in the store. And I don't, it's hard to integrate across all of that. I would love something where, if anyone's got something that does this, let me know. So for example, like I sort of think about sort of a personal relationship score.
Mm-hmm.
So a guy sends me an email and he says, hey, I'm writing a book. I think you'd love it. I really would love for you to write the foreword. And I get one of these every 2 weeks. So I can't write that many forewords. So I have to be selective. So I'm like, I've never seen this guy. He never retweeted anything, mm-hmm. never commented on a nudge. I don't remember being connected on LinkedIn. And so, but I'm not 100% sure because you don't see everything. So I'm thinking, I'm like, I don't really like be a giver before you ask to be a taker. So I'm going to say no. But I would really like to know, like, and be able to make all those connections. So that's, oh, this person's on LinkedIn. Oh, they just came to our website, or like that kind of stuff. So this personal, like influencers, sort of like a personal influencer score, yeah. social media
okay.
influencer score.
No, that's great. That's great. That's something I haven't thought of before. So it's a great idea. Very good. So if you haven't read David's books, please go read both of the books, Turn the Ship Around and Leadership is Language. The last one, Hidden Power of What You Say and What You Don't Say. Really good books. David talks a little bit of Agile in the last book, but they're both great. I've read both of them twice. They've got a place on my shelf, so they're really good. So I greatly appreciate David sharing his knowledge and his experience. Anything else, David, you want to let folks know about that's going on?
Just thanks for what you do, and it's hard. You're working against a lot of years of entrenched behavior. Don't give up. And I invite you to check out the nudges, the leadership nudges on YouTube. I put a link here. And Corey, you can throw that in your show notes if you
Absolutely.
Want.
Absolutely, yeah.
Or just type in leadership nudges on YouTube and I'll pop up. Then let me know, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm L. David Marquet, L for Lewis, but I go by David. So
very good.
Say hi on LinkedIn. Let me know how things are going. I'd love to hear from you.
All right, great. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Cheers.
For any feedback or questions about product ownership, you can contact the show on Twitter at DeliverCast or email at DeliverCast@gmail.com. Please share the show around with friends or coworkers, subscribe, and help us reach more folks. A couple questions. First one is from Amelia, who asks, are no-code tools and building MVP products, tools, off of them, something a PM should know how to do? And more specifically, should that be an expected skill set they bring to the teams? Or do you leave that to other team members? And if so, who would that be, since it's not technically engineering or design? Should product people know how to do no-code type tools for MVPs? I want to say yes. I think it's a really good skill. I think it's something that if there isn't that skill on the team, that's something I see product people doing often. I like doing it because whether it's no-code tools, wireframing, journey mapping, those types of things, sketching it out, I like that to help me think. I like that to try out ideas. I like that to go through and iterate some ideas through. And if I'm not doing it, then I would expect somebody on the team to do it. It could be engineers. It could be designers. There are lots of click-through type prototype tools out there that I think anybody should use. So I think product people could benefit from that as a skill. I also think it's something that if it's already on the team, then don't overdo what they've done. You could do it with them. Maybe you could pair with them. But I think it's something that's really good for your ideation and exploration of certain problems. The next question was from Kimball. It says, I have a backlog with universal tasks. I'm thinking about implementing Scrum on a startup, not just for the development, but for leading the overall vision of the company. The team's just four people, and I was thinking of building a backlog with the tasks that leads to that vision. The backlog can contain experiments related to market approach and sales, but also features to develop. Does it make sense to build a backlog that mixes technical with non-technical stuff? Absolutely, Kimball. This is fantastic that you are looking at this with your company, not just a team, but your company, and making sure the company is aligned around the same thing, doing the same problem, doing that together. I think that's great. I do that often. Like I've said, I've used, and lots of people have used Kanban board Scrum to plan real world scenarios. I think it's great when leadership teams use Scrum or Kanban or something like that to work. It really instills that with the rest of their teams. If you're talking about groups that are 40, 50, 100, 5,000, however big the company is, seeing leaders actually use agile methods and practices in their daily operation, the way they run their group or the way that they do their job, that makes it much more likely, in my experience, that the people below them will be much more successful. So I like this idea. Yes, have all those things in there. It would be good to make sure you use something like a different color for the different areas, if there's one that's product and one that's HR or something like that, just so everybody knows and you can keep it all in the same board. I think that's a great idea. So good luck, Kimball, and I hope you succeed. All right, once again, thank you to David Marquet. We will have all of David's links and items that he spoke about, his books, his leadership site, really good stuff from David. Can't say enough to thank him and to continue to watch all the great content that he puts out. That'll do it for this episode. All opinions expressed here are mine. You can find more of them at Corey Bryant. On Twitter, that is episode 132 delivered. Go out and own the outcome. Podcast Network. For more shows and information,
visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.